Well, this morning's study, which, if you're keeping an account, is part 9 of our series in Old Testament history. And at the rate we're going, we'll probably be done in about, 8.7 years or so. Just kidding. Shouldn't take that long, but as I said before, these early studies are particularly in-depth because there's so much that has happened since the creation of man, since man's expulsion from the Garden of Eden, the development of human society. There's just a lot going on, and we need to cover as much of it as we can, especially those things that are more momentous in terms of our understanding of history itself. This morning's study brings us to the next momentous event in Old Testament history, which is the Tower of Babel incident recorded in Genesis chapter 11. Genesis chapter 11. Chapter 11 begins with this statement in verse 1. Now the whole earth used the same language and the same words. Now this certainly stands to reason, given that every person alive at the time was in fact descended from, and really not that far removed from, one of Noah's three sons, Ham, Shem, or Japheth. Perhaps the most interesting question here would be, what was the language that was spoken by the world's inhabitants before the Lord confused that language? Now, there are some who like to think that it was Hebrew. That's really more of a romantic notion than it is anything else. There's no proof whatsoever that Hebrew existed as a language that early on. Plus, there's really no need to describe the language in that way because the Hebrew people themselves didn't exist at this early stage of human development. So again, there are a lot of people who want to, think it was Hebrew because Hebrew is the oldest monotheistic culture that we have in the Scriptures. But again, there's really no way of knowing that for sure. Many scholars are of the opinion that while the language originally spoken by Noah and his sons may have had some resemblance to what developed into ancient Semitic language, given how language evolves, even over short periods of time, there's really no way of knowing for sure what the original language itself was. You can take English, for example, and the English that we speak today is far different from the English that was spoken, and this might shock some of you, but the English we speak today is far different even from the English that was spoken as recently as 50 years ago. You know, there are things that you may have heard your grandparents say, your great-grandparents say, that catch you off guard. And you're asking, what does that mean? You know, even those of us who are a little bit older than some of you younger people, even we have trouble sometimes understanding the modern vernacular. You know, there are so many evolutions in language, period. English is one of the best examples of how that actually happens over time. Go back as far as like the 17th, 18th century, and it's very difficult. Go back even further to medieval English, or go back even further to the Old English, and it's very difficult to make heads or tails out of any of it. Any of you read Shakespeare in high school or college? Any of you have trouble discerning what Shakespeare is talking about? Absolutely. And that's just Middle English. That's not Old English at all. So it can be very confusing, even over short periods of time. All that to say that by the time Noah's three sons began to disperse and began to settle in other places, their language could have changed. That language could have changed itself in significant ways. Imagine when God confuses the languages, how many different languages may have actually evolved from that particular incident. Before we talk about the language itself, though, and how God confused that, let's begin, as they say, at the beginning. It wasn't long, relatively speaking, after the ark was found its resting place in the mountain range of Ararat, which again was a fairly extensive mountain range. I hate to break the news to people who have spent millions of dollars going to a single mountain in eastern Turkey looking for Noah's Ark and claiming they found it, but it's quite possible that Noah's Ark actually landed hundreds, if not thousands of miles away from that particular location. We just don't know. There are some interesting things that have been found there by way of early culture, but we can't really ascribe those definitively to Noah's Ark. But when the ark came to rest in the mountain range of Ararat, it wasn't that long after Noah's cursing of Ham that Noah's sons and their children began to expand throughout the known world at the time. Now, remember, Japheth's name means enlargement. So Japheth himself is responsible for expanding out through what we now see as most of modern Europe, parts of Asia. Ham's descendants were fairly limited to Africa, to the southern Middle East, and in that region. And of course, Shem's descendants, they would have been more likely to stay in the area in which they landed. And we can see that geographically by their association with the modern-day Palestinians and Jews. And so as they began to expand out in all directions after they stayed initially in their post-flood home somewhere in the Ararat mountain range, they either traveled eastward or, as the King James English Standard Version or other translations have it, they moved from the east. We really have no way of knowing whether they moved eastward or moved from the east. Again, if we don't know where the ark settled, that's one difficulty that's presented there. Another difficulty is in the Hebrew language, it's kind of confusing as to whether or not this is talking about movement from a location or toward a location. There's been some debate on both sides of that. It really doesn't matter a great deal because we do know where they ended up. We are told where they ended up. They ended up in the land of Shinar. And where is that? Anybody know? Huh? Iraq. Or biblically known as Babylon. They ended up in Shinar, which is Babylon throughout the Old Testament. We now know this as Iraq. The land of Shinar was choice land because it was right in the middle of what is known as the Fertile Crescent. You probably remember that from your high school geography classes. The Fertile Crescent is that area of land that's particularly fertile, rich in nutrients, relatively flat, close to the Tigris and Euphrates rivers. It was more of a delta-type area where farming had great success. And so as they began to expand, they came to the land of Shinar, and they said, this is the place. What's particularly interesting about this part of the world is the fact that even secular geographers and anthropologists acknowledge this as the place where the earliest record of civilization is found. You go to Mesopotamia, Ur of the Chaldees, everywhere along that Fertile Crescent where the Tigris and Euphrates rivers are, and you find some of the earliest examples of man's existence that's been found anywhere in the world. Now, there are some commentators who have surmised that these nomads were largely from the descendants of Ham, but there's no real evidence of that beyond what seems to be a scholarly desire to blame everything on Ham, right? Of course, Ham and his descendants moved to this area because Ham was mad because his father Noah had cursed him. He wanted to get out of there as quickly as possible, so Ham said, "Come on, family, let's go." Is that true? Do we have any reason to believe that it was just Ham's descendants, or primarily Ham's descendants, who actually dispersed from their post-flood home and moved into the land of Shinar? No. No. There's a common misconception that a lot of people have adopted over the years concerning these three sons of Noah. And, you know, again, it stands to reason that we would think this way about them because Scripture does kind of paint this picture for us. Ham was the cursed one. Japheth was the one who would be enlarged in terms of his land holdings and so on and so forth. Shem would be the father of the Shemites or the Semites, the Jewish people. So it's almost like we've developed this mindset of Japheth and Shem, good. Ham, bad. Right? And so when they all started moving, we just automatically assumed that it was Ham and his descendants that led the charge out into the great unknown and settled in the land of Shinar. We need to remove that way of thinking from our minds. We need to understand that as man is prone to do, I don't care whether you're descended from Ham, Shem, or Japheth, even this early on, sin was a problem for all three sons. Even this early on, they would have been restless. Even this early on, they would have been easily cajoled by one another and one another's families. There's no doubt that they began to intermarry. There's no doubt that they began to dilute the original purity of each son's gene pool. And so, by the time all this happens, we can, I think, reasonably deduce that all three of the tribes began to move out. They began to move. And I think there was this mass sort of exodus going in the same direction, which is why all of them ended up in the land of Shinar. But I don't think we can blame one of the sons, namely Ham, for this type of thing. We can assume, and I think we should, that the journey was made by the descendants of all three sons. Anyway, when this group approached the land of Shinar, they said to one another, "Come, let us build for ourselves a city and a tower whose top will reach into heaven. And let us make for ourselves a name, otherwise we will be scattered abroad over the face of the whole earth." Now let's just stop there for a minute and see if there's any additional historical insight we might be able to glean. For example, who was the ringleader of this nomadic group? Do we know? Who was the ringleader? Who was the one who was in charge, large and in charge of this nomadic group moving from their post-flood home into the land of Shinar? Actually, we do know. Go back a chapter to Genesis 10. Go back to Genesis 10. Let's read verses 6 through 10. Genesis 10, verses 6 through 10. Here we read, "And the sons of Ham were Cush, and Mizraim, and Put, and Canaan. And the sons of Cush were Seba, and Havilah, and Sabta, and Raamah, and Sabteca. And the sons of Raamah were Sheba and Dedan. And Cush became the father of Nimrod. He, Nimrod, became a mighty one on the earth. He was a mighty hunter before the Lord. Therefore it is said, like Nimrod, a mighty hunter before the Lord. And the beginning of his kingdom was Babel, and Erech, and Akkad, and Calneh in the land of Shinar." And so you can see that even the chapter before preemptively lets us know that Nimrod was the leader of the bunch. Nimrod was the one who founded the city that was then called Babel, which was then turned into Babylon at some later point. I'm sure you can appreciate, as I said a minute ago, there's simply zero historical information that exists from the exact time frame spoken of here. That is, there's no contemporary historians that we know of that we've been able to find their records and discern anything really more about this area. Most of our information that we've been able to glean has been in the form of pottery and other artifacts from archaeological digs. For the most part, it remains kind of mysterious, though, who these people actually were, what they believed at this stage of their development, and so on and so forth. Again, most of the information that we're able to glean comes from the scriptures themselves. Now, one of the earliest historians that we do know of who wrote about this particular area and the people involved was a man named Berossus. Berossus was a Babylonian priest and historian who gives us this extra bit of information. And I always love it when secular historians are able to shed light on scriptural truth. Right? That should excite all of us because it simply validates what we all know to be true, and that is that the Word of God is trustworthy and reliable. And so in this particular case, Berossus wrote this. He says, Nimrod came with his people into the plain of Shinar, where he marked out a city and founded the largest tower in the year of deliverance from the waters of the flood, 131. What does that mean? It means 131 years after, right, the deliverance from the waters of the flood. He reigned 56 years. He carried the tower to the height and size of mountains, quote unquote, for a sign and monument, that the people of Babylon were the first in the world and ought to be called the Kingdom of Kingdoms. Now, this helps shed some light on what's meant in verse 4 of Genesis 11, when the people said, let us make for ourselves a name, otherwise we'll be scattered abroad over the face of the whole earth. It's very likely that these original settlers knew and feared that their relatives, who were still growing in their own little places where they had populated the post-flood home that all of them had known, it's quite possible that those who moved into the valley of Shinar, into the Fertile Crescent, it's very likely that those people feared that their other relatives may very well at some point stumble upon them and seek to take what they had secured for themselves. Folks, this is just the way of the world, is it not? Conquest. You know, people get so upset today over what they see going on in the unsaved world around us, we need to understand that what we're seeing, even in Ukraine, as bad as that is, as horrific as war is, all we're seeing is this constant vying for power that has gone on since the very beginning. They had reason to fear. If you read even secular history, the earliest records of what went on in this particular area, you can see that Babylon itself changed hands many times over the centuries. Try to make it secure, yes, but do so with the understanding that it's very likely someone bigger and stronger than you is going to come in and root you up from that land. It happened here in the United States. You know, again, I think sometimes we get our Christianity mixed up with our Americanism. You know, our rugged individualism and determinism can sometimes cloud how we should understand fallen man and the things that he does to his fellow image bearers of God. I've said before, even in this country, well-meaning, God-fearing men, under the guise of so-called manifest destiny, expanded westward, building cities, building railroads, building all kinds of infrastructure. At what cost? At a horrible cost. You get in their way, you present an inconvenience to them in any sort of way, They will kill you if need be to remove you from the land. We've done the same thing. Don't let anyone, children, don't fall for the revisionist history which will have you believe that our acquisition of this land was a noble thing. It was not. Has it been blessed by God? Yes. Absolutely. Are we grateful to live here? Yes. Absolutely. I'm not denying the providence of God. I'm not denying the goodness of God. But we need to understand that every human civilization that has existed on planet Earth has supplanted other people to get where they are. It's just the way of the world. And guess what? Even the Native Americans can't really complain. Why? Because even among their own various tribes in this country, they've been uprooting and supplanting one another since long before the white man ever showed up. It's just the way of man. It's fallen human nature to do these things. And it's interesting to me that this early on, people are concerned about making a name for themselves, about becoming strong and mighty. Even this early on, they knew that there would be a tendency for someone to come in and remove them, to scatter them. I think it's fascinating. When the people made this obviously prideful and selfish declaration that they needed to make a name for themselves, otherwise they'd be scattered abroad over the face of the earth. When they made this declaration, how did the Lord respond? Well, before we talk about that, let me just shed a little bit of additional light on something that you might have learned in your children's Sunday school class decades ago, for some of you. God was not afraid that these people were going to build a tower that would reach into heaven and disrupt His existence. How many of you heard that growing up as a child? The reason God confused all the languages is because He was afraid that they would build a tower so high that they could reach Him. Really? Don't get me started on the fact that heaven is really just an interdimensional thing, not really an up or down thing. Right? Never mind the fact that you could use all the resources on planet Earth, right, and never be able to create a tower so high that it would reach where God is, if He is in some place up, right? So that's not why God dispersed them. That's not why God confused their languages. The reason God confused their languages was because of their pride, because of their arrogance, because of their assumption that they could be untouchable if they would only make a name for themselves, if they would only build a mighty tower that would stand as a reminder to all other civilizations, don't come near us. Look how strong we are. Look how impermeable our tower is. Anyway, in verses 5 through 9, when the people made this, again, this obviously prideful and selfish declaration, the Lord responded according to verse 5. He came down to see the city and the tower which the sons of men had built. The Lord said, "Behold, they are one people, and they all have the same language. And this is what they began to do. And now nothing which they purpose to do will be impossible for them. Come, let us go down there and confuse their language so that they will not understand one another's speech." So the Lord scattered them abroad from there over the face of the whole earth, and they stopped building the city. Therefore its name was called Babel, because the Lord confused the language of the whole earth, and from there the Lord scattered them abroad over the face of the whole earth. Now there are a couple of really important questions that arise from this particular passage. First of all, what did the Lord mean when He said that the people would all have the same language, which would in turn mean that nothing which they purpose to do will be impossible for them? What does that mean? Does that mean they could do anything? Steve? Yeah. Yeah, I mean, their sin of pride and arrogance and the visible manifestations of that sin, which would be towers and cities and you know, everything that man does in terms of using his own hands has caused man to go further and further away from God. It's true. It's demonstrably true. We can see this I've talked about the three philosophical eras in which man has existed. You know, we have the pre-modern era, which is where man relied more or less on God for everything, right? You can see this historically. There was a complete and utter reliance, not necessarily on the one true God of the Scriptures, but on this concept of God. People were sacrificing to deities way back when because they lived in this pre-modern mindset. There is a God. That much is made clear in Romans 1. There is a God. We don't necessarily have to know Him in order to know that He's all-powerful and He will snuff us out with just a thought, if that be His desire. And so man lived with this understanding. There is a God. He is to be feared. That's the pre-modern era. What happened after the pre-modern era? The modern era was ushered in. The modern era would include things as early as the Renaissance, things as early as the mechanical age, the industrial age. All of that was part of the modern era. And in the modern era, man began to believe that his own creations could solve all of man's problems. And what happens when man becomes disappointed or disenchanted with the idea that all of his things can solve all of his problems, all of his inventions, all of his manufacturing, all of his advancements in science? What happens when all of that begins to break apart and prove not to be what they claimed it was? Well, then you have the postmodern era. You would think that the postmodern man would return to a pre-modern mindset. Folks, we need to go back to God. That's not what happened. What happened? In the postmodern mindset, people think, well, God didn't do it. He didn't solve all of our problems. Our technology didn't solve all of our problems. So, there must not be any absolute truth. There must not be anything that is able categorically to solve all of our problems. What they did, they jettisoned the idea of God. They put aside the idea that technology is able to save us. One of the biggest contributing factors to the introduction of postmodernism was the nuclear age, where man suddenly woke up one day after Nagasaki and Hiroshima and said, if we're not careful, we're not going to only not going to preserve ourselves, we're going to kill one another. We're going to obliterate all life on this planet. And so that really created this disenchantment with the idea that, okay, technology can solve all of our problems. It can't. And so they threw the baby out with the bathwater, so to speak. And now we have a society in which there are no absolutes. There are no objective truths. We don't have a society who worships God. And so when God confuses the language of these people, He's actually trying to circumvent this early onset of postmodern thought. He didn't want them all being able to communicate so effectively that now they were able to just forget God altogether. Render Him null and void. So what does God do? He comes on the scene and in dramatic fashion, He reminds them that He is still in charge. He reminds them that they're not going to be able to do what they want to do. That's what that phrase means. He didn't mean that there would be nothing impossible for them. That's silly. He meant in their own minds, there would be nothing impossible for them, which would be a catalyst for their forgetting God altogether. Now let me ask you another question. When the Lord does what He does here, is He reacting to a problem that He hadn't foreseen? There are a lot of people who say, yeah, God, once again, You know, he put man here and he allowed him to migrate to this valley all with one language. Man got a little above his raising, and so God comes in and says, well, I didn't expect that, so here's my solution. All the languages are confused. Is that what happened? No. No. How do we know? Well, remember our primary presupposition regarding such things. If we understand that the Lord has sovereignly and immutably ordained all things whatsoever shall come to pass, then we must also understand that the people's migration to this land called Shinar, their prideful attempt to build the tower, their attempt to make a name for themselves, which again was their way of attempting to establish their independence from God and their fellow men, as well as the Lord's confusing of their language, all of this was in accordance with His perfect sovereign plan and purpose. All of this was ordained from before the foundation of the world. That's our primary presupposition. And that's the presupposition that helps us understand things that are otherwise easily misunderstood. Now, don't miss the grand irony here. The pride of man had become so great by this time that he thought himself able to build fortifications strong enough to prevent anyone from scattering him. Right? It's not unlike the castles that dot the European landscape even today. If you've ever been to Europe, you can go all over Europe and you can see these massive castles with 10, 12, 15 foot thick walls. I mean, these were designed by men who thought they were 10 feet tall and bulletproof. They thought they would live forever. They thought that their castles were impermeable. And you can see today, after the onslaught of the Allied forces during World War II especially, most of these castles are in ruins and have been for centuries. They became quickly obsolete, right? But the grand irony here is these people thought they could build something that would be impermeable, indestructible, would preserve them as a people, prevent them from being scattered. And what does God do? He comes in and really, we're not even told how He did it. I think it's just like He said, let there be light. I don't know if He even said anything. He probably just thought, okay, their languages are going to be confused. And what happened? Their languages were confused. Can you imagine? You're going to be like talking to a toddler suddenly. Right? I mean, you go from talking like we're talking now in perfectly intelligible language and all of a sudden, you don't understand anything. Number one, that'd be frightening, right? Ian. Yeah. They probably wondered if there weren't some type of massive stroke, you know, happening amongst them all. I mean, I can't imagine what that might have been like. But again, the irony is quite tasty here. They thought themselves to be invincible. And God convinced them they were not. Immediately. Confused their languages, scattered them abroad. Now again, I believe that the Lord's reason for acting in this way was twofold. I believe it was His way of reminding the people that He was still sovereignly in control of every aspect of man's life. And two, I believe He wanted man to understand that the sin of prideful arrogance would, in fact, have consequences. Now, if you think about it, what the Lord did on this particular occasion was an act of mercy. What the Lord did was save man from himself. Now, we don't often think about things in those terms, but I believe that's exactly what happened. Yeah, Steve. That's another interesting wrinkle. I think if you had a situation where every single individual was suddenly unintelligible to the one next to them, I believe that goes from mercy to cruelty. I don't know. Good point. But judging what I know about God Himself and how He operates in the realm of mankind, I believe it's quite possible that He gave individual groups the same language so that they could at least converse with one another. You know, I believe that would be an act of mercy. But we're not told. He would be perfectly just in confusing all of their languages, would He not? I'll talk about it more in a minute. I was going to jump ahead, but I'm not going to do that. Let me just ask you a point of application here. Have you ever had a situation in your own life where the Lord interrupted your own plans for your own good? Duh, right? I mean, how many of you have ever made plans that sound grand? We're going to do this, and we're going to do that, and we're going to do that. And yeah, it's going to be great. And then the Lord dashes your plans on the rocks. And then only later do you realize that had you carried through with your plan, ruin would have ensued. You know, if you live long enough, you'll see this sort of thing happening over and over and over. This is why, I believe, this is why we're told by James, don't say that tomorrow we're going to do such and such, and we're going to go to this place and that place. James says, say, if the Lord wills, we will do these things. Parents of young children, it's a great way to introduce your children to the sovereignty of God. Simply adding that phrase to everything you promise them. Hey, are we going to Fiesta, Texas? Like you told us we would. If the Lord wills, yes. But He could very well change our plans. Now don't use that as an excuse either. Right? Don't use that as an excuse to lie to your kids. Well, the Lord didn't will, so no, we're not going. Now it could be that you're a knucklehead. Don't be a knucklehead. Again, if you live long enough, you're going to see that everything the Lord does in your life, if you truly belong to Him, is for your good and His glory. And it's amazing, the older we get, how we can start to see that in crystal clarity. Some of us will die not knowing why certain things happen. That's okay. Because we can still have the settled assurance that whatever happened, happened because everything He ordains is right. What a comforting thing. Well, going back to our text, what are we to make of the Lord saying, let us go down and confuse their language? Did the Lord use the help of angels to do this? What's up with this us thing? What we see here is another example of the triune Godhead committing together, as it were, even though they are one God. We don't understand the Trinity. But in the same way as they said, let us make man in our image, they now say, let us go down and confuse their language. They didn't need the help of angels. Listen to Gil here, not Irma, but John. Gil said, angels could not be in this work of confounding the language of men, it being above the power of creatures, so to work upon the mind and the faculty of speech, as to make such an alteration as was the confusion of tongues, when men were made to forget their former language and had another put in their minds and a faculty of speaking it. As most conservative scholars agree, what we see here again is the work of the triune God who saw the need to disrupt man's plans and correct them accordingly. This is what I was going to mention a minute ago. I think we see a parallel to this in Acts chapter 2. We see a parallel to this in Acts chapter 2. On the day of Pentecost, the Holy Spirit can be seen reversing the curse of Genesis 11. You know, this is a fascinating thing to consider. If you understand exactly what happened in Acts chapter 2, and again, for my Pentecostal, quasi-charismatic friends, the gift of tongues was not the gift of gibberish. The gift of tongues is not the ability to speak in unintelligible syllables just to impress people with the notion that you have an extra measure of the Holy Spirit that they do not. The gift of tongues was the spontaneous ability to speak in a language that was understood by multiple people at the same time. A language. For example, if you were Russian on the day of Pentecost, I'm not sure how that works out, but let's just say you were Russian, and there was a man who had come from New Zealand on the day of Pentecost to witness the goings on as proof that God's promised Holy Spirit had arrived. Rather than the New Zealander learning Russian, rather than the Russian learning English, God spontaneously gave them the ability to speak to one another and to hear one another in their own languages and dialects. That's the gift of tongues. Can God do the same thing today? He can. Does He? There's no proof that He does. You'll see anecdotal little tidbits of information that, you know, a lot of people like to remind you that this mysterious missionary somewhere went there not knowing the language and was spontaneously able to speak that language to the people. Every missionary I've ever talked to who has gone to a foreign land would love to have that gift. But talk to 99.9% of them, and what will they tell you? They all have to go to language school. Let me ask you this. If the mission field was so important, and it is, if God is still giving that gift, why would He not give that gift to the missionaries who go out into these lands? Why would He not grant them the spontaneous ability to communicate to those people and they with Him in their language? It's a good question, right? That's because the day of Pentecost and all that went on this day was formative and not normative. And it was very much a reversal of what went on in Genesis chapter 11. Instead of confusing men's tongues, the Holy Spirit enabled men to speak in one another's languages and dialects. Now let me ask you this. Languages, very, very interesting, is it not? Have you, anybody here, where's Freddie at? Is Freddie not here this morning? Is he translating? He's probably translating. Freddie, if you're translating, this sounds silly if you're not here at all. Is he here this morning? Okay, good. Good. He's in Sunday school. Okay, good. Anyway, Freddie is a linguist. Freddie loves languages, and I wish he were here this morning because he could tell you that of all the languages that he studied, he's always amazed at the similarities that exist between some of the most unlikely of languages. I recall going to Romania years and years ago and hearing the Romanians speak, and a lot of what they say in their own language sounds a lot like Spanish, which is predicated on Latin, which is the language spoken in Italy. So you can see all these migrations of people going all over the world. A lot of the words in our own language, most of the words in our language come from three sources. Four. Most of the words in English come from Latin, French, Greek, and German. And you can see these commonalities between all of the languages, right? There was a study done back in 2011. The study was published in the Journal of Science. And in this study, secular scientists determined that the world's 6,000 plus modern languages, and this is from the English that we speak all the way to the Mandarin Chinese, every language that they were able to run through this computer in terms of, you know, when they run languages through the computer, they're not looking for words or syllables. They're looking at what are called phonemes. Phonemes are just sounds and inflections, uses of the tongue that can pinpoint the similarity between the languages that people speak. These scientists were able to determine, certainly with the help of their supercomputers, by running all of these 6,000 languages through the computer and listening for the computer's listening for these phonemes and so on and so forth, they determined that with almost certainty, every language on planet Earth came from one mother tongue. They say spoken in Africa 50 to 70,000 years ago. I think their location and their time frame is a bit off. But why couldn't they have just read Genesis 11? Because they did have one mother tongue. There was one language that was confused into other languages. And you have to imagine that God being a God of order, there was similarity. That might be the answer to your question. Maybe there was enough similarity in their languages that they were able to communicate. They just weren't able to pull off some of the shenanigans that they had been able to pull off up to that point. We don't know. But I thought it was fascinating. You know, if you are a linguist, if you've ever studied languages, you can see the similarities between all of the languages that point back to the existence of some kind of mother tongue. They'll also tell you that it was human expansion that caused the change in the languages. But the Bible tells us it was the change in the languages that caused the human expansion. I think, like Steve surmised, I think it's quite possible that they broke off into little groups and went hither and yon to establish their own little tribes, as it were. So, fascinating that God would resort to such means just for the case of pride and arrogance. And again, see it as a merciful thing, not necessarily as a punitive thing. What could God have done? He could have just wiped them all off the face of the earth. He had done that not too many generations before, save for 8 people. He could have just come in, knocked down their tower, and killed them all. He didn't do that. Again, as a demonstration of His mercy and grace, He simply confused their languages, and off they went. Now, where did they go? They went to the places that we've talked about in terms of the descendancy of Ham, Shem, and Japheth. This is what really began the expansion that Japheth's descendants would enjoy, that would include most of modern Europe.